Hi, and welcome to installment number 5 of The Art of Relating. This is your host, Zach Schwartz. I'm a psychologist, but I'm not doing this show. But remember, this is not for psychotherapy and not for counseling. I don't do those over the radio. This is for us learning together a set of concepts and skills that will help us interact more effectively and in a happier way, and in a more loving way, and a more efficient way over time as you integrate the concepts and skills. Remember to, if you want, visit the website dynskills.com for podcasts of earlier shows, for books, trainings, other material related to this show. Also, remember to email any questions to zach@kepw.org. That's zach@kepw.org, and I will try to answer those for the next show before we get into new material. Tonight, I want to talk about something I call working assumptions, but I did get one question last week when I talked about anger, which is, how do I help myself to not get angry? And I thought, well, that's a common question that I get when I talk about anger. I do anger management for a living, but anger management is not anger elimination. Remember that anger is natural and happens to everybody. It's an emotion, natural and spontaneous. Managing my anger is learning how to protect myself without abusing anyone. It's not learning how to never get angry, because I think that's impossible. So thanks for the question, and please ask for more over time. Remember to ground yourself before you start anything. Like I'm grounding now. I set my posture. I set my breathing. I arrange my self-talk to relax, to affirm I love me, I'm valuable, to unhook. It's all small, time out, stay focused on the here and now, whatever your grounding self-talk may be, to find center before you begin, like I'm finding center before I start tonight's show. So what is a working assumption? It's when I teach the concepts and skills for effective interacting, and that's what this is about, effective humanistic interacting skills, the concepts that are involved are working assumptions. That means I ask you to proceed in an interaction as though these things are true. They may not be true for you, or you may not believe them, but to succeed, have a three-chip interaction, fun, love, and get the business done, you have to proceed as though these things are true. And most of the concepts we talk about here and the skills we talk about here are indeed working assumptions. Train yourself to approach conversations with this in mind. The principles here might help you become a better person. They might help you be happier. They might help you be more loving or empathetic. Those are great fringe benefits, but the main benefit is that they will help you to have three-chip interactions, which are the most efficient and positive possible. So there are three working assumptions that I talk about in the material. The first is that the person you're speaking with is a hero in their own movie. That is to say, they see themselves as a good person trying to do good things. If it was Peter Pan we were playing, they want to be Peter Pan, they want to be Wendy, maybe they want to be Tinkerbell, but they never want to be Captain Hook. So if, for example, I catch someone wading across the Longtime River to sneak into the country fair, I don't interpret their actions as trying to rip us off or theft of services. I'd rather interpret their actions as they're working really hard to join the party and share our having a good time. That's how they would see themselves trying to make that move into the fair. And I can show them ways to work their way in or earn a ticket, and that will get them into the fair more safely and more positively. And that's relating to their own positive sense of who they are. So they're a hero in their own movie. That's the first working assumption. The second working assumption is that they know themselves better than I do. So as we proceed in the conversation, regardless of what I may believe in my head, where they say they're coming from, what feelings they say they're having, we're going to take that as true for the moment. They know themselves better than I do. If I say to someone, oh, you're telling me this about what you're thinking or feeling, but I know what you're really thinking or feeling, I am saying to them, this conversation's over, start fighting. They're going to get defensive. Things will not proceed well from that point. I have to assume that what they're telling me is where they're coming from. They are the only one living inside that head and heart and body, and they have to report what's true for them. The third working assumption is that they're not the other person messing with me on purpose. They're being what I would call sincere. Honesty, being honest, which I value, is the same as being sincere. It's not the same as being accurate. In fact, we'll talk about this more in a while. I'm not even sure what accuracy means, but I have to proceed in a conversation as though what they're telling me is truly what they're feeling. They're reading me the maps in their head and heart and body as best they can. And to assume that means they're being sincere. Again, as with they know themselves better than I do, if I question someone's sincerity, they are naturally going to feel vulnerable, usually quickly followed by anger, and the conversation again will not go anywhere productive. So I have to assume sincerity. Now, I can feel confused. Confusion's okay to share. I can say, I'm confused. Yesterday, I thought you told me, I heard, that you hate asparagus, but I'm seeing you eating a bowl of asparagus, and I don't understand. I'm confused. The other person will be glad most of the time to clear this up for me. They will tell me either I didn't hear them right yesterday, or there were conditions on that. Try and remember that none of us communicates perfectly, so whatever we say is only a facsimile of what we're thinking or feeling, and we use language different from each other. For example, say, if my spouse says to me, and I love her dearly, I cleaned this countertop 10 times yesterday and nobody helped, and I say, which 10 times were those? Because I only saw you cleaning it twice. I would be misunderstanding her completely and blowing the interaction. And that would just make her angry or defensive. When she says, I cleaned this counter 10 times yesterday and nobody helped, I said, what I heard you just say right now is that you did a bunch of work cleaning up and nobody else did their share. She would say, that's pretty close. Had nothing to do with the countertop, had nothing to do with the number 10. If I myself said, I cleaned this countertop 4 times yesterday, say, and you said, which 4 times? I'd say, 10 o'clock, 1 o'clock, 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock. I mean this counter and this time. That doesn't mean one of us is insincere or dishonest in any way. It means that we use language differently. She tends to speak in more feelings and metaphors and sensations. And if I focus on that, at least my version of her, I tend to be more accurate with my reflections, with understanding her, with being able to validate her. If I hear her saying things in the way I would use the words, we tend to fight. The things don't go well. I don't understand her as well. I can't offer the same empathy or validity as if I come to understand the way she uses language and the way she speaks. Again, she knows herself better than I do. She's being sincere. And she's a hero in her own movie. She's a good person doing good things. So I have to find a reflection, a feedback for what she's telling me that fits that model and that she can say, yes, that's what I was trying to say. If, by the way, she says, no, that's not what I was trying to say, I have to erase and re-record. Let her go again. Again, if she knows herself better than I do, all I can tell her is what I heard or understood when she spoke. That's not the same as her intended message. If it's close, she says, yeah, and we both know I'm hearing and understanding. If it's not close, if she says, no, I wasn't saying that, then I have to let her go again until I can reflect it, feed it back in such a way that she says, yeah, that's close to what I was saying. By the way, and while we're talking about it, or at least I'm talking about it, what I just gave an example of is what I call active listening. That's not my term. That's been around for a long time. But the second most common fight, and we'll talk later about three fights that happen more than any other fights in the dances we do together, whose right fights are the most common, but I'm going to spend a whole installment on that in a while. But the second most common fight is you're not listening to me fights. You don't understand. Whenever, if you want to not have that fight, whenever someone says you're not listening to me or you don't understand, what I would suggest you do is feedback. Feedback the map you just made of what they said. That's called what you heard. And give them a chance to say yay or nay. If they say yes, then you both know that you were listening because that's where you got the information. If they say no, they get to go again. And you listen again and you reflect again. Feedback, make what they call a perception check, which includes not only paraphrasing, you don't want to just do that, but also a sense you have of what they're trying to say. A feeling, things you got from their facial expression or their body language or their tone of voice. That's all included in the message that you get. It's why I don't like to do counseling or therapy over the phone because you miss a lot of the message. I miss a lot of the message if I don't get the information I can get from actually being with the person, which is how I'd rather work and how I'd rather interact. Now, my spouse and I, for example, and I recommend it, have an active listening contract. So whenever one of us feels like you're not listening to me or you don't understand me, they get to, without justification, ask for reflection, which means feedback your understanding of me to see if you got it right. And right only means that was what I was intending to communicate. And we give each other that permission any time to give that kind of feedback, to share a perception check to see if we're right. I work with a lot of couples in treatment, and I do a lot of this kind of work with them. And I will stop. They'll be having a conversation. I will stop them at a random moment and ask, say, the guy, what is she saying right now? What are you hearing right now? And he'll say, oh, I know what she said. And I'll say, well, humor me. Give it a try. See if it's close. And I can't tell you. They will share something. And I can't tell you, wow, how far off it often is. People ramble on in interactions thinking that they're hearing each other or understanding each other. And when I stop them at a random moment and ask them to check that out carefully, they have miles between each of their understandings about where the other person is coming from, or sometimes where they themselves are coming from. But doing this active listening and having an active listening contract is one way not to have you're not listening to me fights. And the signal, what reminds me to ask for reflection, is a feeling I get when I'm feeling like she doesn't understand or she's not hearing me. And that feeling, I can train myself through classical conditioning that feeling associates with my saying, point of order, can I have a reflection before you continue? And again, we have by contract each other's permission to do exactly that. Now, nothing's perfect. And if one of us or both of us are not grounded, for example, at a given moment, then me asking for reflection when I can see that one of us is upset or ungrounded is, again, putting process before ground, and that's the wrong order of things. So ground always comes first. Learning to pause so that we can ground and recenter is what allows us to return to a positive process. And that's when I would ask for the reflection. Sometimes I'll be, say, reading the newspaper in the morning and eating my Cheerios, and my wife will come in and share something with me. When I notice that she's talking to me, I look up and say, "Huh?" And she would say something like, "You're not listening. Could you reflect, please?" And I would say, "Didn't get any of it. Start over." Well, the problem there is not that I don't want to listen, and it's not that what she's saying isn't important to me. The problem is a problem of rapport. Before I can start an interaction with someone, I have to have their attention. So by the time I realize she's talking to me and I look up from the paper and focus, she's already gotten done saying something, which I heard none of. So she says, "Reflect, please." I said, "I didn't get over any of it. Please start over." And then she can repeat what she was trying to tell me. If it just annoys her that I didn't hear it, then the first thing is, you know, "Hi, let's take a breath, calm down. I'm here. I'm listening." We're on radios out of the country fair, but I don't get on the radio and say, John, can you meet me at booth 345? No, I have to get on the radio. This is protocol, and say, "John, this is Zach. Can you hear me?" And then maybe John says, "Yes, I'm here." And then when I'm sure we're connected, I can say, "Could you meet me at booth 345? But we have to have rapport first, or I have no idea that this person is giving me their attention. And usually the way I know that I have someone's attention is by getting some response from them that makes sense to me. I can't, because you're looking my way or because you don't seem to me to be doing anything else, assume that you're hearing me. I have to say hi, and I have to get a hi or something back that tells me we're connected. Once I have that, I can proceed to share whatever I like. And then the act of listening stuff and asking for reflection and staying grounded, of course, always then that all of that becomes relevant and works. Now, sometimes someone shares something or does something that I would think is usually not good behavior. Say somebody screams at somebody or somebody hits somebody. If I ask them a neutral question like, "What happened?" after I help get them grounded, of course, they will tell me a story about how they came to lose their temper. It's not that usually they would defend hitting someone as okay behavior. It's that they were protecting themselves in some way. And again, if I validate that part, I'm not saying it's okay to hit somebody, but I am saying I understand why you felt vulnerable, why you felt that a need to protect yourself at that moment. And that's me starting to understand their interpretation of their own actions. And I also find that when I do that, rarely do they defend that hitting somebody was a good idea. What they instead say is, "I didn't know how else to protect myself at that moment." So me helping find that story and helping them develop alternatives and helping them develop a resolution to that crisis, and they're still accountable for the behavior, but me helping develop that resolution, how to keep themselves safe and how to resolve this action and how to be accountable for what they did, all supports the notion, again, that they're a good person trying to do good things, and that's the way generally people see themselves. Another example is that, say somebody lies about something. We've all had some experience of that with others, with ourselves. Usually when somebody lies in response to a question, they're trapped, they're cornered. the truth will get them in trouble and the lying will get them in trouble. They don't know how to get out of it. If my partner, for example, demands that I not drink beer and I am compelled to have a beer for one reason or another, and then I come home and she says, "Did you have a beer today?" I am tempted to say, "No, of course not," even though I know that's not sincere. So when I work with someone or myself that's been trapped that way, the puzzle question becomes, how do I get out of this corner? How do I negotiate this issue differently without having to be insincere, which is a second crime and more damage to the relationship than if I answer sincerely? The trap is that I think my sincere response is going to cost me too much in the relationship. That's the trap. So how do I get out of this trap is a good constructive question if I'm working with this person to resolve the issue. And of course, the person being lied to now is also angry, and they're also protecting themselves from feeling betrayed or manipulated. And that's natural to feel when you sense that someone's lying to you. Same with them. I'm working with them on how to get out of that trap. Creating sincerity in a relationship is not always simple and easy. It's a simple value to get behind, but it's a hard thing to purely achieve. I have to slow down. I have to stay grounded. I have to spend time working things out with myself, which is an advanced part of grounding, and then figuring out what is a healthy and respectable way for me to solve this dilemma. I have to insist on sincerity and openness, transparency, to have a healthy partnership with someone. That's a really important thing. But again, sometimes easier said than done. I have to work at this. We have to share this values. If a couple is thinking of making vows to each other, I've done a bunch of that, premarital sort of counseling. One of the vows is that we won't lie to each other. Well, again, that's an easy thing to say when I'm not feeling cornered or trapped. But what happens when I am? That's the challenging part. That's where I can learn and get stronger and figure out. To be honest, to be sincere, maybe when I feel trapped is to say, "Give me a minute, I'm feeling trapped right now." I have to solve this puzzle with myself before I can share something sincere and transparent with you. So it's challenging and there's lots to learn and it takes a lot of practice, like the use of most of these concepts and skills. Now, as I said, "you're not listening to me" fights are the second most common fight that people have. But the first and the most common fight that people have are what I call "who's right" fights. "This is what happened," one says. The other says, "No, it didn't. This happened." Or, "you're angry." "No, I'm not." "Yes, you are." Or, "you told me this." "No, I never told you that." Those are all examples of what I call "who's right" fights. And the solution, the way, is simple in concept, again, more difficult in practice, but is to accept, to share and listen and feel only in the subjective tense, so I can train myself to think and listen and share subjectively, which is closer to what I would call a respect for reality than thinking that there's some or one objective thing going on. For example, you and I meet together at a cafe to have a conversation, and later a third person asks you, "So what happened at your conversation with Zach at the cafe?" If you say, "Well, here's what happened at the cafe," and I overhear you saying that, I'm likely to say, "That's not what happened," and we can start a "who's right" fight about that. But here's the truth of it. When we met at the cafe, you made a map of the meeting at the cafe, and that map is built of what I call sensation and projection. Sensation is the light and sound that hit your eyes and ears while you were there with me. Projection is your existing moods and feelings and values and history that all contributes to what sort of map you make of the meeting. So since our sensations are always different and our projections are always different, we end up with two different maps of the meeting at the cafe. Also, when I make my map of the meeting at the cafe, because I'm not a perfect map maker, I leave some things out and I add some things in and I change some things around. Can't help it. So again, the map I've made is not the same accuracy-wise as the meeting at the cafe. And actually, again, there were two meetings at the cafe, the one, my map of it and your map of it. Those are different, but equally valuable and equally worth listening to. So if someone asks me, how did the meeting go at the cafe? What happened there? I will answer, this is what I experienced there, because that's all I have is my map. And I'm not even sure what actually means, except I actually know what I experienced there, what my map looks like. And that's what I'm sharing. So if someone else says that's not what happened, I can say, didn't say it was. I was just reporting my experience. Yours is just as valid. Share yours. And all I'm gathering from any of the people involved is their map, which adds to my data, but doesn't really give me objective information. So remember, sharing my map as expertly as I can at a given moment is the best I can do, to be honest or be sincere. That's what it means. I'm sharing my maps as accurately as I can, which again is far from perfect. And when I hear someone else's map of the situation, I can edit my own, but I'm the only one who can. You can't edit someone else's reality maps. You can only edit your own. But if you're open to data, to hearing someone else's experience, you can then make adjustments in your memory. That's valid and okay. So these are common errors in interactions, but I never know what you told me. I only know what I heard. Someone says, you know, what did Bob tell you? I say, well, I'll tell you what I heard. That may not be what he meant to say. If you want to know what he meant to say, you have to ask him. If you want to know what he actually said, good luck, because I'm not even sure that it actually exists. Now, all the maps that a person makes in their life is what I call their world. That describes that collection of maps, their reality. And notice, wowie zowie, to make this more complicated, that not only are some of our maps different from each other, but no two of our maps are the same. So we're walking around together on this planet, as far as I can tell, with entirely different realities of what's going on. And somehow we have to function together in what we call a shared reality sometimes to make things work. And making things work with the reality differences we have is what we in psychology call compensation. When someone's decompensating is when they might get locked up as crazy. But decompensating means they're not playing well with others. Having delusions, having hallucinations, and again, those things are hard to find sometimes, hard to define, is not what crazy is based on. What crazy is based on is decompensation, not playing well with others. We have to find a way to harmonize our reality. We're out of time. I'm going to pick this up where we left off next time, but remember the three working assumptions and keep practicing grounding and listen to the other podcasts, which are on the website at dineskills.com. Have a great week. Speak to you Monday.